So how much did it cost you to make that music video?
It ended up costing 10 grand. If I had known that, I wouldn't have done it. And it wasn't until about February that I kind of, it almost felt like waking up after a dream and, you know, watching my savings account go down basically to zero. And I was like, I'm going to upload this video to YouTube. It's going to get 1 million views. And I knew that that video would bring in maybe $100.
From NPR, it's How I Built This, a show about innovators, entrepreneurs, idealists, and the stories behind the movements they built. I'm Guy Raz, and on the show today, how Jack Conte's frustration with the music business led him to launch Patreon, a crowdfunding platform where fans can support and connect with creators for just a few dollars a month. At some point, you might get tired of hearing me say that every great business idea often starts as a problem in need of a solution. But one reason I keep coming back to this is the sheer, almost stupid simplicity of it. Like, it's an equation you could explain to a six-year-old. Frustration equals idea equals action equals solution. Think about Jamie Siminoff, who worked out of his garage. He needed to see who was at the front door when the doorbell rang to decide whether to get up and open the door or stay put. So he built a video doorbell for himself, and then he turned it into a business called Ring. Melissa Butler couldn't find bold and bright lipstick colors, so she created her own, and then turned that idea into a business called The Lip Bar. Mike Radenbaugh had to bike 17 miles to high school, so to make that journey easier, he turned his bike into an electric bike, and that idea eventually became Rad Power Bikes. And Jack Conte's problem? It was a problem that, at first glance, doesn't seem that problematic. Back in 2009, he and his then-girlfriend, now-wife, Natalie, formed a band called Pomplamoose, and in September of that year, they released a cover version of Beyoncé's Single Ladies, and they made a video to go with it. This video got millions of views, and their YouTube channel blew up. They were doing media interviews and selling some of their music on iTunes. So you're probably wondering, what was the problem? Well, having lots of followers and viewers doesn't necessarily translate into a sustainable business, especially after all the middlemen take their cut. So Jack set out to solve this problem, and he wondered, is there a way for artists to make their art in a sustainable way without a big record label or publisher or studio backing them? And the answer he came up with is Patreon. Patreon is a platform that connects artists with their most passionate fans, fans who willingly pay a monthly subscription to support their favorite artists. Since its launch in 2013, Patreon has attracted about 200,000 creators, including some names that you might know, like YouTuber Jackson Bird or the musician Beardy Man or the podcast Chapo Trap House. But mostly, Patreon helps support people you've never heard of. Ukulele teachers, graphic artists, film reviewers, science fiction writers, fantasy footballers. And that's sort of how its creators, Jack Conte and Sam Yam, envisioned it. For starters, both Sam and Jack had creative instincts from very early on. Jack grew up in the Bay Area, where he was fascinated with puppetry and loved making his own animations. Sam grew up in Pittsburgh, where he worked as a waiter at his parents' Chinese restaurant and actually really loved programming his calculator. And from a young age, both of them were also really into music. Sam played classical piano, and Jack started out playing jazz. In fact, their mutual love of music might be why they were paired up as roommates when they started their freshman year at Stanford in 2002. Here's Jack.
I think it was just one of those relationships that was relatively, I mean, at least, Sam, my recollection, it was, like, easy. Like, it didn't take a lot of work. It just kind of worked.
Yeah. I think we also sort of had a very easygoing humor to us, that we found maybe some of the same macabre type things funny, and the same friend groups that you eventually brought over, I think really resonated with me too.
So what were you guys studying in college? Jack, let's start with you.
I studied music. You know, my whole life I'd been on the arts had kind of been like the side thing, but I was on the science and math kind of track growing up. And I loved physics in high school. I thought I wanted to be a physics major when I got to college. And then I remember getting to this, like, the next level of physics, and I was sitting in a class, and I think movies often show you, like, one moment of realization, and life is rarely like that. Life is usually, like, a slow burn. But this was really one moment of realization for me sitting in this physics class where I was like, this is not what I want to do. And I was just thinking about songs. I was thinking about my music theory class. I was thinking about other things, and that's where my brain was going. And I didn't want to do physics. And I remember, like, sitting on a bench after that physics class for probably 45 minutes. I just sat there and just thought about what that meant for me, because it was kind of one of those moments in college that feels pivotal, you know.
So Jack, you were studying music, and Sam, what were you studying?
Yeah, I came into Stanford not really knowing, to be honest. Ended up studying computer science. Honestly, I played a lot of video games as a child, and then I was into computers.
All right, so you are doing computer science, and Jack, you're doing music, and I'm just curious, did at any point in college, did the two of you sit around and start to kind of mull over the possibility of starting a business together or anything like that? Was that ever a conversation you ever had?
Never.
Never.
And Sam did start businesses. Sam, you were doing that In-N-Out delivery thing.
In-N-Out Burgers?
I was. Yeah.
It was awesome.
You were driving In-N-Out Burgers for people?
I created a website. I was driving burgers around and to campus. That was my senior year in particular.
Pre-DoorDash.
Sure, yeah. That I would love to take that credit.
You would take orders for burgers, drive to the burger place, and then deliver them to dorm rooms?
to individuals. It wasn't super well thought out. Again, just, you know, riffing on ideas here.
Yeah. Sammy, why are you ashamed of this? This was an awesome business, man. It was so cool. It was a big deal. Like, everybody knew about it. It was one of those things.
You just mark up the burgers. I think he's worried he's going to get sued by In-N-Out Burgers for what he did in 2004 or for whatever, 5. But I will say this. I don't think it's a great idea, because a delivered burger is just not... You have to eat a burger right off the grill. Like, it's in a car, it's in the box, it gets soggy, you get it to your house. It's not the same thing.
I totally hear you. Yeah. Also, the shock every time, every night that I would go to In-N-Out and order like 100 burgers or something, and then how they would have to hold up for everyone else in line, not a good feeling. So,
not a good feeling. All right. So you've got this burgeoning entrepreneurial business. And Jack, were you like, was any part of your mind in college about business, or were you really just focused on music?
No, I don't think I was thinking about business at all. I was a part of the film society at school, and I was also there was a recording studio on campus, and so I was learning how to use a recording studio, and I was also, you know, because I was part of the film society, I was making movies, so I would make, you know, a few movies a year, and I would do soundtracks for other people and for myself. So I was, you know, I was a music major, and then, you know, in the cracks, I was doing music and film and all that kind of stuff. I was not building businesses.
All right. So you guys both graduate in 2006. And Sam, I guess you go to work for the first of many startups. And it was called Looped. And I guess it was like an early way to share your cell phone's location.
Yeah.
What happened to that startup?
Looped ended up getting acquired. I was there for about 3 years. My takeaway from it, like early on, I was really interested because of the founders, particularly Sam Altman, who was the CEO there. Later, I became president of Y Combinator. And we had a whole bunch of other impressive folks there. And I think just being around that talent felt very energizing.
So Sam, you kind of go off into this tech direction. And Jack, I guess you kind of begin to pursue music. You formed a band with your then girlfriend, who's now actually your wife, I think, right, Natalie?
Yeah, we started a band called Pomplamoose. And even before then, I had started using YouTube and uploading to YouTube. And it kind of, it like felt like something was working. So I'd put up a video and get a few thousand views. And
what were the videos of?
Me in my bedroom playing instruments. And so I would...
Listen, people put videos up opening baseball card packs today. So, I mean...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would... I guess what the videos kind of became was the video version of a song. I called them video songs because there were sort of two rules. It was inspired by the sort of dogma filmmaking from the 70s. And like the rules were, if you hear the instrument in the mix, if there's an instrument in the mix, you're going to get to see it.
Oh, yeah. You have to play it, right.
Yeah. It's like all direct sound and, yeah, that kind of thing. And I really liked the idea of taking some of the mystery out of audio production because it really feels like magic when you listen to a record. You know, there's all these sounds. You have no idea how they're made. It just, you know, it feels like these people are geniuses just creating things. And at least for me, it felt like there was this gap between like where they are and where I am. And I just liked the kind of transparency of YouTube. I liked that it felt like behind the scenes. And I liked the idea of kind of showing people like, hey, this is how sounds are made and here's what it looks like. And it doesn't have to be super glamorous. Like you can be in your pajama pants on the floor of your bedroom playing a guitar through a shitty amp that you got, you know, on sale at Guitar Center.
And what kind of music was it, by the way?
It was like hardcore rock, like aggressive, intense, like electric rock. Yeah.
And people, yeah, there's a market for that.
Yeah. And so I graduated and started working on music, and it, you know, felt like it was working. I would sell a few $100 of MP3s. I used a site called eJunkie. So I would put up my MP3s for sale on this platform.
And were people buying them?
Yeah. I was making a couple $100 a month, and I thought like, oh, okay, this could turn into, you know, an income stream, and I could do this full time. It was the first time in my life that I felt like that would be possible. I remember like going back to that moment in college, you know, when I made the decision to become a music major, it was actually like a very depressing moment for me. I was committing, in my mind, I was committing to a life of poverty. My uncle is a guitar player, a jazz guitar player. And he, you know, when I told him I was going to do this, he was like, Jack, the thing he said to me was like, don't do it. He was like, you can do anything else in your life. You're a smart guy and you can do anything else. He said, don't do this. It's crowded at the bottom is what he said.
Wow. But I mean, you have this band going at the time.
Yeah, we got the band going. When we posted a YouTube video on my channel, at first we didn't call it a band. We just posted a video on my channel. We said, hey, this is me and Natalie collabing.
And what were you? What was the video?
It was just the two of us with a song that she wrote called Pas Encore. It was mostly in French.
Because pamplemousse, of course, is grapefruit in French.
And that comes from her because she grew up in France and Belgium.
I got it. Okay. Yeah.
And what was funny was, you know, we kind of tempered each other. Like we mitigated each other's extremes. So like she calmed down my kind of industrial screamo side and I kind of upped up some of the softness of it. And the combo was just, it was cool and different. And like it had some of my aggressive production, but then she has this very soft voice. And I think it was just kind of different sounding and people seemed to really like it. And so, you know, the idea was, let's see if we can make a living out of this. And right around that time, iTunes came out. And so we started putting our music on iTunes.
This is original music.
Original music. Yep. You know, we knew that was kind of what we wanted to do. And so we just, and YouTube seemed like it was working. So we just started making more and more videos and putting those out.
How did you get attention on YouTube?
Eventually, we produced a record for this singer-songwriter named Julia Nunes. And I was super inspired by Julia because she just had this huge presence on YouTube. And I learned that it came from covers originally. And she would put
covering big, like, well-known songs.
Yeah, because...
Which anybody can do, right?
Which anybody can do. Yep. Yeah, and that's kind of when I learned that YouTube is a search engine. And so people are searching for songs that they know. And if they then see a cool band who is singing that song, but maybe in a completely different way with a completely different sound, and they've ripped out the harmony and put in their own harmony and ripped out the beat and put in their own beat and done it in 3/4 instead of 4/4 or whatever it is, you can kind of get introduced to a new sound because you're coming from search traffic. And that single thing is how we ended up like growing the band so quickly.
So what was the first cover that you put on YouTube?
It was, I think the first cover was My Favorite Things. We ended up doing it in 5/4 and did a cool arrangement of it. But that wasn't the one that hit. The one that hit was when we covered Beyoncé's Single Ladies.
Oh, yes. I remember that well.
Yeah. We happened, we knew that it was going to have a good shot at the VMAs because it was such a great video and a great song. And when she was up for you know, best yeah. music video, and so we covered the song and kind of just in time and put it out that night. And then Kanye did that thing where he got up at the VMAs and
when Taylor Swift won.
Yes, and interrupted her, and it became this huge like internet meme and just got tons of traffic, and the video just exploded.
Because people were searching Single Ladies.
Yeah.
I think that video today has about 11 million views.
It does, yeah.
And you guys, and I've seen the video, obviously, and it's you guys like in like a bedroom, right? Like,
yeah, it was my childhood bedroom. Like, that's what it is. It's people in a room playing instruments synced up with the audio. And like, it's funny because in 2020, that's really nothing special. But at the time, nobody was really doing that kind of thing. Like, music videos looked like music videos. They looked like MTV. And to see like humans in their bedroom playing instruments and having it actually sound good was, you know, it was different.
So that video blows up, and did you start to get contact? I mean, I should say that I know you were on NPR around that time, because I was the host of Weekend All Things Considered, and there was a weekend when I was like on vacation, and you guys, sadly, wasn't able to interview you, but you guys were featured on the show. So did you guys get a lot of calls?
We did. I mean, that was kind of the beginning of when Pomplamoose really started to take off. And, you know, we got calls from managers, we got calls from, you know, press. And, you know, that when we came out with our second, like, big one that kind of really took off, which was Telephone by Lady Gaga, you know, we released a record. And, you know, at the end of the month, we logged into our bank account and, like, we had sold 30,000 songs. And because we hadn't signed with a label, we owned all our own masters and therefore we owned all the royalties. So we logged in our bank account and had $22,000 in it.
Wow.
Which, like, coming out of call, like, after selling...
That's just from iTunes. That's just people paying 99 cents for your song on iTunes.
Just iTunes. $22,000 in 1 month. And, like, that was when I was like, oh my... Like, I thought, this, we can do it. Like, this could be a thing.
And did you start to get record labels contacting you saying, hey, you guys interested in talking to us?
We did. Yeah, we didn't get, like, hard offers from anybody, but we started to go down to L.A. and talk with them, and we basically decided not to do that. But we did talk with them and entertain it. We just didn't want to go that route. I mean, you know, at that point, we were making a living. You know, when we started doing label conversations, we were making, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars per month. We were going on tour. We were, you know, reaching millions of people.
Where were you? We were performing in front of, like, big audiences?
Yeah, 500 to 1,000 people.
Wow.
So, I mean, not like, you know, we're not playing Staples Center, but like...
That's still pretty great.
Yeah, I mean, when I grew up, like, I thought, like, maybe one day I'll play for 100 people. You know, like, that was like, that would have been the coolest thing. And then here we are playing these clubs, you know, for, like, we played Fillmore, you know, in San Francisco, which is 1,200 people. It was magic. It was the best thing ever.
Sam, while all this was happening with Jack and Natalie... You're grinding away in some tech job, and you're watching these guys become like massive YouTube stars. Was like everyone from your year at Stanford, like people you knew, like talking about them? Like, oh my God, you see Jack Conte's like got this YouTube video. It's got 11 million views.
I mean, yeah, I admired Jack, right? Like from my own personal experience, I loved art too, but I could never take on both that risk or even bridge the connection of how I could make that like a livelihood or part of my life. And so seeing him be so successful down that path was so impressive. And I remember every time that we would catch up after college, I was just fascinated by what was going on with his life and how things were going on there.
Meantime, Sam, you had left. You had left the first startup you worked for and went on to found your own startup. Called AdWorld. What was AdWorld?
Yeah. I mean, thinking back on it, a lot of this was quite boring, but This was during the era when the iPhone was getting really popular, and
yep.
a lot of developers were creating their own games and whatnot. And in fact, my co-founder and myself at that time were also making these iPhone games and applications. And there was a lot of good money in advertising in that. I know we created like this virtual pet game that ended up gathering actually millions of users at the time. And we were seeing a few thousand dollars come through and just ads being clicked on. And so AdWorld was just an effective way for these mobile developers to monetize that.
So you from what I've read, you guys basically start this business in early 2009. And by the end of the year, you're acquired by a different company. Is that, I mean, to me, that sounds like a great deal. But I can't even imagine you were up and running that, like, really, by that point, or were you?
It happened pretty quickly, like just the explosion of even interest in this space, I think. Like there was a whole flood of developers who, it was almost like a gold rush in a lot of ways, because you had the iPhone and this new app store, and anyone could start making games and get it distributed to millions of users. And so when there was this interest in what we were doing, I think we were also caught off guard in some sense, and then also immediately sold the company that same year.
Did you sell the company because it was just like an offer you couldn't refuse? Like you were just offered all this money, and you were just like, oh my God, we got to take this.
It wasn't all this money, but I think it was more than we had made, you know, independently previously than that. So the fact that it was a company that we knew to be very large in the space, it was a company called AdMob, and then literally the month afterwards, we were acquired into Google.
AdMob was acquired for like $750 million by Google.
Right, exactly.
And to be clear, that was not your money. You did not get $750 million from Google.
No, we did not get $700. That would be okay if that happened, but we were part of AdMob at the time they were acquired in. And so it felt like an appealing opportunity to be part of something that was going to win.
All right, so your business was acquired and you moved on. And you actually went to the incubator called Dogpatch Labs, where I guess your goal was presumably to come up with like a new idea.
Yeah, I mean, I had a few different things, but at this point, I just wanted to start building again. Mm-hmm. So within those few years, I built a number of things. I think this was sort of enlightening for myself too. In a lot of ways, I view those years as like the years of struggle, because I was there at the incubator. I was working across the table from Kevin Systrom, who's building Instagram at that time. And we would come in. I remember actually having a bunch of chats with Mikey and Kevin about what they were thinking about with their business. And all of that's really exciting, I think, as you all feel like you're in this shared suffering together until, you know, something like Instagram skyrockets. Yeah. And then you realize that
they're
you're
not suffering.
In a separate space. Yeah.
No one's suffering. Yeah. All right. So you're trying to come up with a bunch of different ideas. And when you say building things, like just you'd have an idea and you start to try and build it, like code it?
Yeah, I would code, design, launch. And this was during the time, too, where TechCrunch Disrupt was a thing. So you had this mm-hmm. idea that if you got a business through and you could launch on stage, that would be making it. And so I had launched a business in that area. It was a company called Chompon, but we effectively allowed people to create their own Groupons. So it was a white labeling service. And it was interesting. Like the whole group buying space was sort of coincidentally a flash in the pan, too, in many ways, although Groupon is still around. And the takeaway for me was just how difficult and how much I should treasure if I ever had the good fortune of landing on a business that really resonated with like a community or a group of people. And so most of that, my years during this time was, as I recall, just full of a lot of loneliness and development by myself in my bedroom.
I want to go back to Jack for a moment. So Jack, just like I'm trying to understand, while Sam is working in the startup space, you're making music with Pamplemousse, right?
Yeah.
And at your peak, I'm just curious how much money were you guys making?
We did about $400,000 in a year off of MP3 sales, basically.
Wow.
And it was, I think that year in particular, I think it was 2010, most of it was singles. A lot of it was licensing and brand deals. And we had a lawyer that we had brought on very early on who was, you know, helping us negotiate these deals and work with, work with brands. And we're very, you know, we're both like music nerds and artists, but we absolutely were thinking about like turning this into a, you know, a sustainable thing. And so we ended up buying a house and we built a recording studio. We used the money to build a recording studio on the property. And then that became kind of like the home base for Pomplamoose for the next few years.
I mean, you guys were doing really well, and I presumably a lot of that money was coming in from iTunes sales. But then I guess like around 2010, 2011, Spotify comes along, and of course with Spotify you can stream an unlimited amount of music for free. So what did that do for your revenue?
Yeah, the transition to streaming was really hard on the band. Our streaming revenue was, you know, a tiny, tiny fraction of the iTunes revenue, where people are, you know, paying a buck for a song. You know, with a stream, you get, you know, fractions of a penny for one stream. And it wasn't one for one, because the user base wasn't there on Spotify yet. So the volume wasn't making up for it. And so, you know, the income started to evaporate, which was very scary, because now at this point we had a mortgage.
So around that time, like 2011, you know, 2012, how are you making a living?
Well, what was bizarre about it was, you know, our reach hadn't changed.
The reach of your YouTube audience and so on.
Yeah, like we were growing. We were getting millions and millions of views and more views. And then, you know, enter Spotify, and suddenly we're like up a creek in terms of revenue. And what was amazing to me, that, you know, I was watching this unfold over a period of, you know, a couple of years. What blew my mind was like, wait a minute, I'm not doing anything differently as an artist. There is a system changing in front of me with that I'm not in control of. It's just these changing systems. And my artistry is yielding different results with regard to my income. And that was like very frustrating to watch. And I know businesses have to kind of like pivot and change and be innovative. And yet I found myself like having to do all this gymnastics, you know, to keep up with the revenue stream. So I was, you know, selling hats and t-shirts, and we were selling dongles.
Like on a website?
Yeah. And then we would, you know, play some shows. And I remember like the whole time I was thinking like, is my value to the world like a hat with a logo on it? Like, that's not what I'm good at. That feels...
It was merch. You were just selling merch at concerts and stuff.
Yeah. And I didn't... It bugged me that we had to do that, because I felt like that's not what makes me special. I just wanted to be paid for... Like, I loved iTunes because I could like be paid for my music, which is what... And I was... Yeah, that... So
yeah.
It was just one of those moments where we kind of realized that everything was changing, and that, you know, 3 or 4 years from now would be completely different.
Meantime, what is Natalie doing? I mean, are you guys, you're still living together. You've got this house and a mortgage. And are you earning enough money to at least pay your bills?
Yes, we are. But we're also watching, it's coming a lot out of savings, right?
So you're not, revenue is not increasing.
At that point, no, revenue was not increasing. Revenue was decreasing at that point. So it was coming out of savings. But our roommate who was living at the house did this amazing thing, and she was going to make an album, and she went onto this new website called Kickstarter and did a 30-day thing. We had never heard of it, and I remember the night that she turned her computer around at the dinner table and showed us, I think she had made $12,000 or $13,000
to make the record. And that really was what Kickstarter was started out for.
Yeah.
It was started for artists. I mean, we had Perry on the show a couple years ago, Perry Chen. That was the point of Kickstarter. It was to help artists make music or records or whatever it was.
Yep. And she did that. And she got $13,000 and got a studio and got a mixing engineer and made a record. And what was so cool about it to me was it was her fans. Her fans stepped up and wanted the record and paid her to make the record, and that just felt right and felt awesome.
So I know that you and Natalie did some solo projects in addition to the work you did with Pomplamoose, and And I guess at some point she decides to do a Kickstarter too, right? To raise money for her music.
Yeah. And that, she ended up raising $104,000.
Wow. How did she reach that many people?
Because Pomp Loose had hundreds of thousands of subscribers and we were getting millions of views. And so
But how did you drive those viewers to the Kickstarter?
They just uploaded a YouTube video. Hey, everybody, I'm doing a Kickstarter. People went bananas. Like, over $104,000
to make a record.
Make a record.
So you're thinking, wow, your mind's blown there.
I was so happy for it. It was so awesome.
And meantime, you're working on your own solo music too. And I guess you got interested in like EDM and that sort of genre. And you eventually wrote a track that you were really proud of and you wanted to make a video out of it. And this was a track called Petals.
Yeah. It was kind of Daft Punk-y, like technologic, you know, and I was listing out all of my guitar pedals. That was the lyric. The only lyric in the song was just a list of all the pedals that I used to process guitar sounds.
Like the brands or the types?
The make, the models and the makes. So like the first lyric is Hog, Pog, Vox, Wah, Octave Multiplexer, Big Man, Memory Muff, Boss Chromatic Tuner. It was just
That's
like
cool.
a list.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah.
Just like a list of pedals. Yeah.
I'm watching this video right now, and you're like aggressive in this video. You're like really like aggressively playing that guitar.
Yeah, I mean,
you look a little scary. Like if my kids saw you, they'd be a little scared of you, Jack.
Yeah, I'm raging. Yeah, that's what music's about.
I should mention to people who aren't familiar with it, there are robots in the video. There's a conveyor belt of, you know, guitar pedals passing by. There's other robots. There's a spider robot. It's like in this kind of laboratory of robots. I imagine this is going to cost you quite a bit of money.
It ended up costing $10,000. I didn't know that when I went into it. If I had known that, I wouldn't have done it. But I didn't have a budget. I wasn't being strategic. I at the time, I thought, like, if I go deep on the business side, I'm not going to do it. Like, because I'll be staring at numbers that don't make sense. And so I'm going to just leave all that behind, and I'm just going to do something crazy and creative. And so I decided not to budget, not to think about that, and not to deal with any of the kind of constraints there. And so I ended up just spending like, you know, $100 a day at Home Depot, you know, building the set and building rotating elevators. And
where did you build the set?
In the studio that Natalie and I had built on the property. And like, I had to, like, I was not a carpenter. So I was like trying to learn how to frame a wall and like, you know, I had to figure out how to cut wood at angles. I got a miter saw. Like I was flailing. I mean, this thing, like, you know, I was just trying to go and make it, but I was enjoying, like, it was really fun. It was just, you know, I was trying to do it little by little, you know?
Did you decide, like, all right, if I'm going to make this, I'm going to do this Kickstarter thing. I'm going to put up a video and ask people to contribute to my project.
I was considering it. The problem with that was I didn't want to kind of, you know, the sort of the Kickstarter conceit was like, I'm going to do this big one thing and I need a bunch of money to pay for it. And that's not, I didn't want to do that. And I didn't want to really force fit it like that.
You weren't thinking of this as a one-off. You were thinking like, I need to steady like money to make projects, to do projects.
Yeah.
So how are you going to do it?
That was the part of me that decided to not think about that.
Right.
And it was terrifying. It was. I remember being pretty scared about that. And I also thought, like, look, if I start being logical about this, I'm never going to make something that's great. It wasn't until about February.
Of 2013.
That I kind of, it almost felt like waking up after a dream. And you know, watching my savings account go down basically to zero. And then maxing out a couple credit cards and then feeling like I was almost like coming out of a dream or something. I felt like I was waking up and I was like suddenly very terrified about like what was on the other side. And I the thought that I had in my mind was, I'm going to upload this video to YouTube. It's going to get a million views. And I knew that video would bring in maybe, you know, $100
from YouTube ads.
Yeah. And I actually got like sick. I got like nauseated thinking about like all of this work and energy and time,
yeah,
the robots, the set, the credit cards, the draining of the savings account, like all of that adding up and thinking like, I'm going to put this thing out and I'm going to get paid $100. And I was angry, but I was also like, I couldn't believe that humans were just okay with this. That like, this is the system that we've designed for artists. It's like, yeah, you put up your thing that you spend your life on, and then you get paid $100 in ad revenue, and then you put up your next thing. And I remember like thinking about what the hell was going on, where all these people who make things and put them online, the economics of that failed to evolve with the distribution technology. So like the distribution happened first, and the economic systems to support that didn't keep up. And so we were in this horrible phase where essentially artists are working for free.
So what did you start to think about? I mean, this is February of 2013, and you're clearly like gears are turning in your head. And what do you, I mean, is there an idea starting to form in your mind about how to solve this?
Yeah, I sat down at my kitchen table on a Sunday afternoon, and what I was thinking about was like, I like Kickstarter, but I want to be paid every month because I need income, because I make stuff every month that's valuable to other people. And at the same time, you know, I was seeing other websites start to accept, you know, like membership organizations, not necessarily websites, but like membership organizations like SF MoMA or, you know, KQED would do these pledge drives. And it happened, it wasn't, you know, you had the option in many of those cases to set up a monthly payment. And so I was like, great. Like, I just want essentially that system.
A pledge drive. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I sketched out this like website so that my fans can do this. And then, you know, of course, I was also looking at all these other YouTubers going through the same thing, and podcasters and news and everybody, anybody who makes stuff and puts it online was going through the same thing. I was like, oh, this should be a thing like Kickstarter where anybody can set it up for themselves.
Right.
And so, yeah, I sketched out.
You physically sketched out like what the website would look like on paper?
I took out 14 pieces of printer paper from my printer. Actually, probably more than that because I didn't know it would be 14 pages. But it ended up being about 14 pages. And essentially, it was a recurring payment between a fan and a creator. And yeah, there was a whole, you know, there's like a content feed and like a, you know, login page and a home page and the whole thing. I'm a terrible designer, and so the, you know, looking back,
I remember at it, these pages fondly.
I mean, it was the worst. It sucked. Yeah, there's no way I could have done that by myself, and so that's when I started like calling various people to see if they could build this for me,
including your former roommate Sam.
Yeah, I called him up, and I was like, so Sam, I've got this idea, and I'm really excited about it, but I don't want to tell you. Like, do we need to sign an NDA or something?
Because you thought my idea is so good.
Yeah,
I cannot talk to people about this.
Yes,
because they're going to steal it from me.
I remember this too, because this was like over the phone, right? And you didn't tell me the idea over the phone. So from my perspective, I was, again, as I noted before, I was just excited to catch up with you, Jack. Like every time it was like, oh, I get to meet this celebrity who's just crushing it out on YouTube. So when we had arranged for the meeting, I wasn't so much in the sort of mentality that there would be this amazing idea and this is what I would be dedicated to. I was more like, I'm curious what you're thinking about and what you're up to, Jack.
Yeah.
But wait, but Sam was like, Jack, nobody cares about your idea. He was like, we don't need to do an NDA. Nobody cares. Ideas are trash. Ideas are worthless. Like, we don't need to do that. And I was like, oh, okay.
He's saying to you what you now know, which is ideas are a dime a dozen. It doesn't mean that it's easy to find a good idea. It's not, but they are. It's execution that matters.
It is only execution. Yeah. Yeah. There are so many versions of Patreon that did not work.
Yeah.
And they were the same idea.
All right, so you go to San Francisco to meet, and the idea that you had, Jack, was it to convince Sam to help you with this, or was it just to kind of bounce the idea off of him?
Oh, I wanted Sam to build it. I was in like hardcore pitch mode because other people had told me no or just didn't seem interested.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted Sam to do it. And he was right about to launch this new project, and he had gotten a TechCrunch article, and it was about to come out. So he said, like, hey, I can't meet till Thursday because I'm launching this
thing. What, so what were you launching, Sam?
This was the photography site that I was working on.
This is like your fifth or sixth startup.
I don't know if you can call them all startups, but a new project that I was interested in. And so I was like, hey, Jack, I'm just busy. Maybe we can meet when this article finally comes out, because I'll have launched it by that point. And that's what we set the target date for. So I had gone up there, again, just expecting mainly to catch up with Jack. And maybe you said too, like, yeah, get some feedback on the idea. That's how you pitched it initially, because I remember being surprised when the switch went off and you started selling me on this, and you were really good, Jack. I do recall like you just talking about both the problem that you and other artists were dealing with today, and especially, you know, that resonated for me because I had seen how successful you had been as an artist. I assumed you were already like, you know, dancing away on your yacht doing fine. So this is really interesting. Hearing this from you,
and what do you remember him telling you about it? So you convinced him not to sign, that you didn't have to sign an NDA.
No, you didn't bring an NDA, did you, Jack? I didn't see one. I remember.
No,
I was, yeah.
No NDA. All right. Yeah, I mean, this is your roommate, Jack.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the guy you lived with for three
I
years.
I know, so much hubris. I'm so ashamed of that.
He's gonna steal this from you.
Dumb. Yeah. I know. It's so dumb.
All right. So you are sitting there in this coffee house, and what does he say to you, Sam? How does he describe it?
Yeah. So the things that came together for me, and now we're looking at about almost 8 years ago, but like it's kind of how Jack mentioned that Kickstarter was a thing already, and there were a lot of campaigns that were really successful on Kickstarter. But what resonated here was the idea that you were helping to support the individual versus a particular project. And for me, the reason that resonated, well, first, as someone who cared a lot about art in my past but could never make it a career, I followed a lot of these people on YouTube. There were folks at this time that were relatively big. One in particular, I remember that I talked to Jack about, Kina Granis, who sort of wrote very personal music and very simple music. And I remember thinking in my head as Jack was pitching this, I would totally just give her money. I would just open my wallet and give her whatever on an ongoing basis if it allowed her to keep producing her work. And I could just see this emotion being shared by all these other YouTube audience members. And so that's the idea clicked for me as soon as Jack pitched this to me. Jack remembers this too. The day of, I'm like, we're starting this now. And don't tell anyone else about this idea. Don't.
So you're saying to him, now make everybody sign an NDA.
No, don't even sign an NDA. Just keep this
don't
to ourselves. This is it. We're
going to go dark. Yeah. We're going dark.
So I'm staring at the email right now that I sent Sam on March 10th. I just pulled it up. March 10th, 2013. And it's just kind of like a summary of our agreement. And I think that's kind of what I thought it was going to be. I'll just read one sentence of this. You agree to be, so we're talking about the agreement. Here's what I'm agreeing to. Here's what you're agreeing to. And one of the lines is like, you agree to be co-founder and CTO of Patreon. You agree to build and maintain the site as it is laid out in the wireframes. You will work on all technical and programming oriented aspects of the company.
Did you pass this by a lawyer, Jack? Or was like, this was your legalese?
No, I just was writing decree. You an email. Yeah, I'm just like.
And did you guys have a conversation about how you would split the company? Did you say, was it just going to be 50-50?
Yeah, it's in this email. We agree to become 50-50 partners in Patreon.
So, I mean, win-win, right? Because, you get a technical co-founder, and Sam, you get this guy who has kind of a pretty big platform already.
Absolutely, yeah. I was stoked.
And a friend.
I think that email, which I did read through, I think I just wrote back to you, Jack. What is it? All caps or something?
No, so I wrote this like long email. At the end, I said like, I know I said this before, but I just want to stress how important it is that we communicate with each other about all aspects of the business and our relationship. As long as we're not hiding anything from each other, as long as we're telling each other if something's wrong, we are greatly reducing the chance of hurting our friendship. I want you to feel 100% okay with talking to me about your, like, the company finances, your interest in the company, your ideas, your feelings, anything you like. This will lead to a strong partnership.
That's nice.
I mean, it's basically like, hey, we put our friendship, you know, first here.
Yeah.
You know, it was like this, I thought it was kind of a nice thing. And then Sam writes back, all caps, Awesome, I agree to all of this. Okay, let's go.
When we come back in just a moment, how Patreon launched with just three musicians, one of them was Jack and one was Natalie, and then why slowly other artists started to get on board, first by the dozens and then by the thousands. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to How I Built This from NPR. Hey everyone, just a quick thanks to our sponsor, Salesforce. Small businesses need a steady partner in today's changing world. Salesforce gives you sales, service, and marketing all on one secure platform, accessible from anywhere, so you can connect your teams, share information, and automate processes. And best of all, they're here to help at any time with service, support, or proactive tips to help you grow. Form deeper connections with your customers starting now. Try it for free at salesforce.com/SMB. Thanks also to ClickUp. You don't need to exist on 4 hours of sleep to be productive. Enter ClickUp, a completely customizable work platform with all the features you've ever needed to build your business all in one place. Join 100,000 teams across companies like Airbnb, Google, and Uber who are already using ClickUp to level up their productivity and save one day a week guaranteed. ClickUp is free forever, so get started at clickup.com/NPR today. Thanks also to Workday. In today's changing world, fast decisions need to be smart decisions. That's why Workday delivers quick insights to help your finance team plan for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system. More at workday.com.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
Hey, welcome back to How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So it's March of 2013, and Jack Conte and his former college roommate Sam Yam have decided to launch a new crowdfunding site that will let fans pay a few dollars a month to sustain their favorite budding musicians, podcasters, writers, and artists. And Sam is so excited about Jack's idea that literally the very day they have that first meeting in San Francisco, Sam goes home to work on the coding.
I started working probably more passionately than ever on any other project. For me, it felt like a race, and I even had this fear, I remember, that if we didn't move fast on this, someone else was going to do it, and we were going to regret that.
And for people who don't understand how coding works, like, what's the first step? Like, I mean, it's essentially, if it's like a bunch of Lego bricks, you start to build the base level of the building?
Yeah, coding is what you do at some point, but what you're really putting together are a whole bunch of like designs and Photoshops and thinking through the psychology of like why a user would do this and that. And so I think the way at least I approached this particular project was sort of laying out all the main journeys of users and then painstakingly moving pixels around to get it to a level where you felt, okay, this is an experience that I think is going
to
work.
And it wasn't going to cost a lot of money to get it off the ground?
No, I mean, I had launched a number of projects before. It was probably going to be a few hundred to $1,000, and I think we were splitting. I think it was in that email, too.
A few hundred dollars to a few thousand dollars, you're saying?
Yeah.
That was it?
Yeah.
Why was it so cheap? Is it because normally the biggest fees would go towards a software engineer, and Sam, you were basically the software engineer?
I think this was the case. You know, I grew up in the area with startups where you had to rent hardware and set up your servers in co-locations. But by this point, several years after that, you could launch an entire service off in the cloud. And that began with, you know, the Facebook apps and iPhone apps. And so by this era, you could launch very cheaply and then sort of scale up as needed. And for us, you know, art, the dreamland that I had in mind around what we were going to do was, Jack obviously had a huge plan to launch to his whole audience. And on top of that, he had this whole network of artists and creators, and we were going to be launching on day one with just millions of fans and artists talking about how you could support them on Patreon. And so I wasn't even thinking about how we needed money.
And that was through, that would be, Jack, through the Pomplamoose web YouTube channel, essentially?
Yeah. In other words, not Pomplamoose, it was going to be my personal YouTube channel, which was, you know, where I was uploading all that electronic stuff. And so the plan was like, I'll put up a YouTube video on my YouTube channel, send my fans over to Patreon, and that's kind of how we'll start. We also, you know, I did want to launch with a bunch of other artists, as Sam mentioned. So we made a list of like 40 or so creators
that you knew
to call up.
No, these are not like world famous creators, right? These are just people who have like pretty strong local small followings.
Folks who I thought like, hey, you're in the same boat that I'm in right now. And let's do this. I think this could be valuable to you. And so, yeah, we made an Excel spreadsheet with those folks, and I found their contact info and reached out to all 40 of them, and all 40 of them said no.
All 40 of them said no.
All 40 of them said no.
They were like, no, I don't feel comfortable asking people to pay me money.
Crickets, yeah.
Were you surprised?
I was surprised, but I wasn't, I didn't think it mattered. I thought like, well, let's do it anyway, and people will come around, they'll come around to this. So I wasn't like bummed about it. I thought, okay, let's do it ourselves. Let's launch with me. Yeah. And my roommate also wanted to launch. Lauren O'Connell was one of the first three creators on Patreon. And Natalie wanted to launch too. So the three of us, my girlfriend at the time. So we launched with just the three of us on day one of Patreon.
And the idea was you would take this video for Petals, a song that you're working on, and that's where you would premiere it. You would premiere this video on YouTube or whatever to get people to go to Patreon and support this video.
Yeah, at the end of the Petals video, I put a vlog where I told people about the idea. And I said, hey, I'm building this new thing, and I don't think it's just going to help me. I think it could help a lot of people. And check it out and let me know what you think. And if you're up for it, join me on this journey here.
So from the time that you guys met on March 6, 2013... to the time you launched, how long was that?
We launched in May, I think, Jack.
In May?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So really quickly.
Yeah. We didn't have all the pieces there when we launched, but we had...
It was good
we
enough.
We had enough, yeah. We couldn't, for example, we couldn't process all the payments at that time yet. I hadn't hooked any of that up. We could accept your credit card, and so that would get saved, you know, very securely, by the way, because we were working at Stripe, but we hadn't built any of the logic to actually handle the processing of the funds.
And what did you ask for, Jack, in the video? You said, hey, whatever you can do just to fund my work, please contribute.
I think I had four tiers.
Yep.
A dollar, $5, $10, and then the night before, I thought, screw it, I'm going to put up a $100 tier. No one's going to buy it, but I'll just do that, where you can kind of do a one-on-one Skype session with me, and I'll hang out with you. And a bunch of people signed up for the $100 tier. A bunch of people signed up for the $5 and the $10 tier. The average payment per patron was around $7, which that really blew my mind. I was thinking maybe people will give me a dollar for YouTube videos, but the fact that on average people would give me $7, I couldn't believe that.
And what was the, like, what did you offer people? If you gave a dollar a month, you would have access to what? If you gave $5, if you gave $10, if you gave $100, what'd you get?
So at $1, you got access to my patron-only stream. You got first dibs on concert tickets. At $3, you got access to my patron-only stream, first dibs on concert tickets, and video tutorials about audio production. I would just make these little extra tutorials and give folks access to them. And then $10 was a Google Hangout once a month with me and all $10 patrons. And then the $100 was the Skype sessions.
So how much did you get fans to commit to paying you per month?
Within the first couple of weeks, I passed $5,000 a month.
Wow.
And then soon after that, it was, yeah, it was even more. And at the time, I was making maybe 2 videos a month. So, you know, suddenly, like very suddenly, within 2 months, I went from draining my savings account to making over $100,000 a year for my solo career.
And Jack, did you envision continuing your career as a musician and, you know, continuing making music and building your fan base in addition to doing this? Or was that not quite fully thought through yet?
It was not strategic. there wasn't a 5-year plan. There wasn't a strategy deck. It was just solving a problem. And so I don't know that I had a clear vision about how the next year was going to go. I knew that we needed to build this thing. I knew that it was going to be a way that artists could make money. I did think it could scale and help a lot of folks. I didn't know how much work that was going to be.
When you had, you know, you reach out to 40 people to sign up and all of them said no, and it's just you, your roommate, and your girlfriend who are the only people on the site, how did you attract other people?
When we launched, and this is how Patreon ended up growing. When we launched, I went onto my YouTube channel. I told all my fans about Patreon, and I said, hey, go to this website. And of course, creators follow creators. So some of the people who watched my video were creators themselves. Right. And when they landed on my Patreon page and they saw this random middle-of-the-road YouTuber making 6 figures, they had that same mind-blow moment that I had had 2 years before when Lauren launched her Kickstarter, and they saw a new revenue model for professional creativity. And then those folks launched on Patreon, and then they did the same thing. They went onto YouTube and they went onto their podcasts and they went on to, you know, they wrote on their websites, and then that cycle just repeated.
Yeah.
And that's actually responsible for most of Patreon's growth, is that viral product cycle.
And was the business model that you had kind of set in stone from the get-go? Because initially I think it was like you would take, Patreon would take 10%, so 5% platform fee and then 5% payment processing fee. And did you kind of do the math and the financial projections and kind of come to the conclusion that that was the best way for you guys to reach profitability?
Jack, did we do the math?
No. No, there was zero projections. There was zero...
No spreadsheets.
No spreadsheets. No math. There was none of that. I mean, again, it's just very different than it is now. Now it's a, you know, now we have, you know, FP&A and finance teams, and we're forecasting out multiple years. And
right.
But that's, yeah, back then, no, we didn't have any of that. We didn't think about any of that. We were just making this thing.
Our first pitch deck, which I don't even believe we had anymore, because I remember building it on a web page, just had all these emails that we had received from artists and fans about how exciting the idea was. So we weren't really thinking about like all the viability of the business at that point still.
And then I guess a month after you guys launch, you decide, all right, now let's go get some money. And Sam, you had already been through this process. You'd been through the process of raising some money for your previous startup.
Yeah, I actually was pretty optimistic and excited about this fundraising process. Again, this came back from the emails and the feedback and the creators and the fans in a way that, again, several years of me trying to build things had never seen this sort of passion around in a movement or an idea. And so, you know, at the time, again, I'm naive, even looking back, it felt like in the bag. And so we started off and we started pitching to investors.
And how much money were you guys able to raise for the first round?
At the time, I think at that round, the company was valued at $6 million. And so we ended up raising, that first round ended up being $2.1 million at a $6 million valuation. So it was, you know, about a third.
Right. And because, you know, this is an important conversation to have, because a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and we've had founders on the show who've said, biggest mistake of my life. You know, Tristan Walker will say, I should never have raised money. Other founders who say, it was so important, I'm so glad I did it. I got support and guidance, and I couldn't have built this without going to venture capitalists and taking the money. Was it absolutely necessary? Could you have done Patreon without raising money?
I don't believe so, Jack. I think we needed that team in the early days as we were building it out. Plus, I think the partners that we ended up working with were very much aligned with the spirit of our mission. And we haven't talked a lot about that, but at the time, this idea that we were trying to get artists and creators paid, that ended up filtering out a bunch of various investors who just didn't even want to touch the space of music or art in particular.
Yeah, I think it was really important. Patreon would not have gotten close to where it is today without that. I mean, even from that first day, Patreon started growing a lot. And, you know, we needed to hire people to answer emails and help build features and scale the company. And we would not have been able to afford that without raising money.
All right. So you guys raised $2.1 million. And what do you do with that? Do you get an office? Do you get? Do you start hiring people? What do you start doing with it?
We became roommates again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we got a home office in Noe.
In San Francisco.
We got an office in Noe Valley. Yeah, it was a two-bedroom apartment. And we moved in together. And at that point, we hired Tyler Palmer, who was the first employee. And he hired a couple folks, Cole and Tony, who started building out the artist relations and the marketing and the and the operations customer service side of the business.
Yeah, it was just our bedrooms, and then it was attached out into the kitchen where we set up a few desks, and they would come in every day, and Jack and I would wake up and walk out into the office.
So initially, the first, I don't know, I mean, you're getting more and more people to sign up, but from what I understand, like, even with the 10% fee, the processing and platform fees, it wasn't covering your costs.
Yeah, no, I mean, we were not profitable. I mean, 5% of the 10%, by the way, didn't go to us, right?
For you guys. Yeah, it was for the payment. Pay Stripe and whoever was, yeah.
Exactly.
So the 5% going to you guys wasn't much.
Not a lot, yeah. Which is, again, because we had that business model with a really low percentage, which came from this idea of not wanting to be another wedge between creators and their fans, right? So we wanted to have a low rake. And so, yeah, even, you know, when the company was processing $100,000, that's only $5,000 for the company.
So, I mean, because you had a runway, $2.1 million, and that was going to run out eventually. How long did that last you before you had to go back out and raise more money?
We were cheap. I mean, again, Jack, even after we fundraised, Jack didn't take any salary. Actually, I don't think I took any salary on the first round either until after our second round. And we didn't spend much. That's why we rented a home as opposed to an actual office. So we didn't end up running out of that money. We had more than, I think, a year of runway left as we saw the business ramping up, and then went on to raise, a much more serious Series A round.
That was in 2014?
In 2014, we raised the $15 million round.
Meanwhile, Jack, you are the CEO of the company, and I'm curious how you kind of figured out how to do that job. Because you're a musician and you've got this part of you that I'm assuming you really want to pursue. Like, how did you, like, first of all, at what point did you were you able to say, okay, I actually cannot pursue music full time. Like, I can't, like, I kind of have to make this a side gig.
So first of all, it was a slow process. I think the desire to not take salary really came from a place of wanting to be a creator and wanting to continue to make art and videos and music. And a couple years into the company, it became very clear that I needed it to be my full-time focus, which was a really, really painful, tough thing. Because not only was this for me, not only did this decision affect me, but my wife, you know, we were partners in crime on this rock band that was kicking ass and getting millions of views and touring around the United States for big rooms. And like, we were living the dream as creators. And not only was I abandoning my career, I was abandoning her by choosing to focus on Patreon. And the moment where I basically stopped working on Pomplamoose and took a salary as CEO, that was a tough moment because I felt I was one of those kids in my 20s who was like, I am not going to be an artist in my 20s and grow up to be a business person in my 30s. That is not the kind of person that I am. I'm going to stay an artist in my life. And then I found myself running a business.
Yeah. And so when you were, I mean, like a year into this, you had no standards, right? Like you didn't have, you know, any particular rules around who could join. What happened in 2014 that changed that? That kind of was like a shot in the arm. I mean, where you guys were like, wait a minute, we need to have some kind of standards here.
The thing that caused the debate was a website called 8chan that launched on Patreon.
Yeah.
And wow. They were using Patreon to fund the development of the site.
And you started to look at the site and you saw crazy, crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there was, you know, sexualized depictions of minors and things that we... Just from a values perspective, it felt like that we should, there should be something in place to stop this from happening.
So what did you do?
Well, I recall this distinctly because looking back, I'm sort of on the wrong side of history of this, but I remember feeling like, hey, we had not sort of done, this would be our first outright ban, which we had never done before. And it was a line that I was very concerned about. I even ended up on the call with the, I guess, the founder of 8chan at the time.
And he lives in like the Philippines or something, I think.
That's right, yeah. And in my mind, and through, you know, the conversation with him too, what was going on was he had built out a platform that was like very heavily emphasizing free speech. And he wanted to take down the things that were breaking the law. At least this is how he represented to me, and that's why I was sympathetic to it at the time. And I was concerned about our ask of creators to, if they didn't have the intention to be uploading these, you know, I agree with, like, just terrible things, like how we could still support them in terms of the business that they were building or the art that they were trying to get shared.
Yeah. I mean, this is really interesting because this is really the beginnings of certain people weaponizing the First Amendment and this idea of free speech, really turning it into a weapon and turning it against what it's designed to do, which is to prevent tyranny. But posting photos of children or even, you know, horrendously vicious and dangerous conspiracy theories is not what that's about. But it's easy to I imagine it would have been easy for him to manipulate somebody like you with the argument that it's about free speech.
Yes, that's how the argument began. And then there were other things that we had to talk to him about too, right? There were communities that were sort of thriving there, spreading hate. And so it started us really going down this path of like, when there is real world harm and people getting hurt, what is our role and responsibility? And I think that's where we started figuring out that we wanted healthy communities and we would have to lay out these guidelines in a very specific way.
So how did you begin to write them down? What did you do? Did you like bring in a lawyer or outside advisors? Or, I mean, because I imagine both of you guys had really good intentions. Like if I'm in a company, I'm going to be sitting there going, guys, we cannot do this. This is wrong. At the same time, you've got investors, you've got to make money. I'm sure the 8chan community was probably generating significant revenue for you.
So, the investors are super helpful here. Besides just the money, they connected us to people who had worked on these types of problems before. Reddit had dealt with stuff like this. Facebook had to deal with stuff like this.
Still does.
And we got connected through those investors to a fellow who had wishes to remain anonymous even to this day. He built these very massive content policy and trust and safety and enforcement systems. And he worked with us for a period of 2 months to draft the first version of what became Patreon's content policy, which was turned out to be about 40 pages was the first version of it. And to tell you the truth, that was one of the most horrific 2 months of my life was...
Why?
Well, because the internet can be a dark place, and there are really horrific things out there. And in that 2 months, we had to explore all of those cases, real, in the world, on Patreon. And we had to have some very deep philosophical conversations about what are we okay with supporting and what are we not. And then content policy is like anything else at a company. It's a living, breathing thing that you iterate on, and it changes over time. But that first version, and the creation of that first version was a very difficult 2 months.
Difficult because you had to make specific choices about what you would accept and what you wouldn't accept?
There are two reasons. The first was Sam and I... This was one of the first moments where we had fundamental disagreements about the business. And so it was challenging our relationship in a way that we hadn't dealt with before. Is that fair, Sam?
I think that's right.
Yeah. Like we had to like have really intense values discussions where we weren't on the same page. And that was really hard.
And in particular, too, we hadn't come up with even a framework for how we would get through these decisions. We were bringing in, I remember there were all these sessions where we would just bring in everyone from the company, and there were all these different like disparate opinions, and we couldn't figure out how to put them together because people were very divided even internally. And I think all of this just became very exhausting for both of us.
So what did you come up with? What was the policy you came up with?
The end state of this project, working with this outside person that helped us, write the first version of it, was this content policy, which was a rules-based framework that gets to a level of specificity that I think most people are probably unaware of. Like, for example, people say, I've heard people say, you can't define porn, you just kind of know it when you see it. I beg to differ. You can define porn. We have spent quite a lot of time defining porn in way more detail than probably anyone wants to hear about or go into. And then do that across everything. Weapons manufacturing, hate speech, what is harassment? The output of this content policy was rigorous definition around what we meant by each of those things and as many edge cases as we could think of. That's how much detail you want to go into.
Yeah, I think the perspective I always liked, I don't remember how we landed on this, was that, we're facilitating art. Art should, in some sense, be bridging a lot of these divides and not increasing them like some communities would be doing. And so guided with that, I think, we're constantly, as Jack noted, it was an evolving document, but at least we sort of knew directionally where we wanted to be.
But I mean, you guys... because of this policy, did alienate some of your better known podcasters like Sam Harris, who was on Patreon, and he decided to stop using it because he didn't support the policy. He said, that it violated free speech. Presumably you talked to Sam about this when he decided to leave.
Well, I talked with Sam many times. He's such an incredible thinker. I respect him so much. And, I was very clear about our logic and why, why we have to have a content policy. And I think these things are complicated if you're not inside a company. I think, things have, over the last few years, it's become very, very clear, I think, to people why companies need to have a content policy. But at the time, his reasoning was the First Amendment should do it. That should be the policy. We disagreed. So and we weren't going to we weren't going to change our minds to keep two or three creators, as painful as that was. But again, I am really proud of our content policy, and I think more folks, should do that. Especially emerging tech companies. I wish more folks did that. It's a bummer, and I wish Sam was raising money on Patreon. His pitch was awesome and straight from the heart and right on. But sometimes, you have values-based disagreements like that, and that's what happens.
Putting out any idea into the world, especially a platform like this, is going to create friction, right? Even though your intentions are good and by and large, it serves people well. There are going to be critics. That's normal. That's part of the process. Our show gets criticized. And you have been criticized for a variety of reasons. Let me just start with one of them. A critique is that actually almost nobody on the platform makes a serious living. There was an article that came out in 2017. I think it was called No One Makes a Living on Patreon. You know, it said something like, you know, 80% of the creators who shared what they earn make less than the federal minimum wage.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's criticism as much as just as like a statement. Perhaps it was meant as right. criticism, but like Patreon, I think, is solving a very specific, clear problem. One of the problems it's not solving is the demand curve. We can't solve supply and demand. We're also not yeah. solving helping everybody find, you know, new fans.
Yeah.
These are really hard problems that other companies do way better than us right now, actually. And we're very narrow in our focus of what problem are we trying to solve. And the very specific problem that Patreon set out to solve early was, so you're a creator, you're reaching millions of people, and you're getting paid $100 a month in ad revenue. Great. Patreon is the platform for you. But if you're not reaching a million people, or it doesn't have to be a million, but if you don't have an audience, actually Patreon doesn't work so well for you at all. And so I think it's totally fair to like point that out. And I actually think it's important to be honest about that. Like, we want to be honest with that. If somebody expects right. they're going to come onto Patreon without having found a thing that you know resonates with people, you know, that's not a problem that our product solves. And I actually, yeah. if we were to try to solve that, it would be incredibly defocusing, and I think we'd end up doing worse at our mission. And at the end of the day, you know, the thing is, there are now tens and tens of thousands of creators who are, you know, making a lot of money on the platform and building media companies and leasing office space and hiring teams, and now there are creators making, you know, millions of dollars a year on Patreon. So, but we're not. You know, we're not going to solve the product market fit problem for folks.
So one of the challenges that you guys have had to deal with over the years is how to roll out changes to your revenue model, because inevitably users, you know, they don't like it when they get used to a certain system and it changes. But a few years ago, you kind of ran into some trouble when you announced that you were going to shift the way that processing fees were being handled. So I guess instead of the creators paying the processing fees, the patrons would have to pay them on top of the subscription fees that they were already paying, and that caused a backlash, right?
There were you were very kind about it. Thank you. describing the backlash about patrons paying fees. That was the worst product rollout in the history of the company. And it was, I mean, backlash doesn't begin to describe how it felt from the inside. I mean, there was a tweet at me every 2 to 3 seconds for probably 72 hours,
wow.
You know, equating me to the devil. I mean, it was, yeah. it was very, anxiety inducing.
It cannot be fun.
It's not. It's the opposite of fun. But we learned so much about, you know, our community and product development and communication and how to talk to our creators. And so the next time we rolled out something like that, you know, we literally talked to over 1,000 creators first, which we did not do that time. We did A/B tests, and like we got the data, and the data showed that actually it was a great thing. But that's different than talking to a person and hearing them react to it and hearing their feelings about it. Like, you know, you can't just disassociate that from the product experience.
Have you become profitable yet?
Sam, are we talking about profitability?
Yeah.
So no, Patreon's not profitable. It's tracking toward profitability. We're burning money every month, but actually the business is like very healthy. The financials are very healthy. And
to help the business, I guess last year you rolled out a new payment plan for the creators, which is a tiered plan. So they, depending on like the level of service they get, they pay either like 5 or 8 or 12% of the income that they get from the site. Is that right?
Yeah. This new plan, the three creator plans that we rolled out have amazing adoption. Creators are you know, opting into those more feature rich products, and so it actually has like changed the business. So like we're gonna keep adding features to those. So I mean, if we're gonna keep building out the product and building more things, but I think very, you know, very clearly, like, yes, this worked. This allows us to like scale and be healthy and be a long term meaningful company.
And how many creators are on the platform now? Hundreds of thousands, right?
It's a little over 200,000. Yeah,
who are getting paid?
I mean, I imagine that this COVID era has been a blessing for. I mean, it's a horrible situation, of course, but all of a sudden you've got people at home. Creators who cannot tour, who can't play in coffee houses, and you're not, you know, it's not like stadium level bands that are going on Patreon, but people who might play to 100 people, now they can't do it. Have you had a massive spike in people onboarding?
I mean, yes, it's been wild to see. I mean, the pandemic has been such a brutal thing in the world, and it is so weird to think about, you know. It is true that it has benefited Patreon, and that dichotomy is very strange for me. Like I think the way I'm trying to think about it is like, I'm glad something like Patreon exists to catch creative people right now in a moment like this. So for example, AEG, Live Nation, both canceled global touring operations. So yeah. Very suddenly there are these creators who are looking forward at a year or two of, you know, touring, and hundreds of thousands or millions or tens of millions of dollars of touring revenue that evaporated over the period of a week.
Yeah.
And so the you know, the level of launches on Patreon are what you could expect in a situation like that. Not only creators, you know, launching on the platform, you know, triple digit growth month over month and in podcasting and music and things like that, but also patrons like stepping up and really doing their part. I think a lot of people are looking for a way to help right now, and patrons are too. And there's like a really easy way that they can.
When you guys think about, you know, this path and where you are today, how much do you think that it has to do with your intelligence, skill, hard work, and how much of it is just luck?
I mean, my opinion on this is largely like, if you're fortunate enough to fall in order to build as part of a community that is this excited about an idea, I felt like if it wasn't us, it was going to be someone else. And so in a lot of ways, at least personally, I feel like very appreciative of sort of the, you could call it luck too, of the timing and the opportunity to do this. I also think, just to the general point of your question, like we wouldn't have been able to make it if we didn't work extremely hard from the get-go.
Yeah. You know, I've done 1,000 things in my life, 999 of them haven't worked. Patreon was one that happened to work. Was I smarter? Did I make better decisions with Patreon? Like, no. I mean, it just was like, there's a lot of happenstance and circumstance, and you know, Sam and I killed ourselves to you know, do it, of course.
But I love this attitude too, because it puts us in a place where I think both of us feel an immense sense of responsibility, and that we have to be great stewards, right, of both creators and the opportunity, and even our teams that are helping us along on this mission. And I think we take that very seriously.
And by the way, one thing that we haven't talked about, which is like quality, like how serious are you guys about the quality of the stuff that's on Patreon? I mean, because I mean, you've been on YouTube, right? And there's obviously great stuff on YouTube.
Yeah.
There's a lot of really awful, mediocre stuff on YouTube as well. I mean, does it bother you if someone uses Patreon to put like, I don't know, like terrible music or terrible art or whatever out into the world? Like, or do you just not care?
Oh God, I mean, we would never like judge the quality of somebody's art and have that be an input into a decision whether to include them in Patreon like that, that we would, of course, never, ever do anything like that.
I actually find it so awesome, too, if there's something so tiny niche that only like a handful of people's passionately care about, right? I feel like that, in effect, is sort of how we've piggybacked off this whole movement on the internet that allows any community to find within an interest group some set of folks who care so deeply about that. So yeah, like Jack said, like why in the world would we ever care about that?
I mean, the beautiful thing about the internet is that suppose you're a total weirdo. Like suppose you make stuff that like in your life, in your town, nobody in your town likes your music. Nobody likes it. Like only 1 in 1,000 people like what you have to make. Like great. On the internet, there are literally millions of people who will like your stuff if your ratio is 1 in 1,000. You can get millions of fans and make hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. Like that is, I love that about the internet. I think that's such a special, weird, wonderful time in the development of humanity to be connected like that.
That's Jack Conte and Sam Yam, co-founders of Patreon. What is the weirdest, most niche Patreon site creator that you've seen? Like just the most odd niche thing that you can think of?
One of my favorite examples of this was just like, I don't get ASMR at all. I don't get it. Like it doesn't work for me.
You don't get ASMR. You don't get it.
Not at all.
It doesn't work.
And my brain is not tingling right now.
I'm getting the tinglies, guys. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Now, are you? Oh, good. You have ASMR people on there?
Yeah, it does really well.
And people pay for it monthly?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I should get on it. This gig doesn't work out for me. I'm doing ASMR on Patreon.
Don't quit your day job.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to the show this week. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to write to us, our email address is hibt@npr.org. If you want to follow us on Twitter, we're @HowIBuiltThis, or I'm @GuyRaz. Also on Instagram, you can follow me @Guy.Raz. This episode was produced by Rachel Faulkner with music composed by Ramtin Arablouei. Thanks also to Liz Metzger, Dareth Gales, JC Howard, Julia Carney, Neva Grant, and Jeff Rogers. Our intern is Farah Safari. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to How I Built This. This is NPR.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.